Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What do we need to know to really understand how we Americans are seen in the world? I mean, what if we could find some ultimate historical master webcam where we could clearly see how we are viewed, that's actually been watching us since 1776? What would we see? Would we like what we see? Well, it's certainly the case that the disconnect between who Americans think they are and how the world views this country is becoming one of the defining fault lines that shapes American foreign policy and the ways in which the people of the world confront American foreign policy. Case in point, today in the Japanese city of Hiroshima, Secretary of State John Kerry visited the memorial to the dead from the atomic bombing in August of 1945, in which 80,000 civilians were killed immediately and 60,000 others died later from the after effects.
It is a stunning display. It is a gut-wrenching display. It tugs at all of your sensibilities as a human being. It reminds everybody of the extraordinary complexity of choices of war and of what war does to people, to communities, countries, to the world.
Complexity. Does it remind everyone of complexity, or just someone like Secretary Kerry, now the highest-ranking official to go to Hiroshima? The consistent position of the United States is that the first use of a nuclear weapon developed to fight the Germans was needed to prevent an invasion of Japan. More than 70 years later, should there be a rethinking of that decision? Was it a consequence of war? Was it an act of terrorism that launched the Cold War? We'll talk about that a little later this hour. Thinking of terrorism, though, the key remaining suspect in November's Paris attacks was arrested late Friday. Mohamed Abrini was captured in Belgium, working for ISIS. Why? What can ISIS do to the United States from Belgium? How does ISIS see the United States? Is that something we can change? Is that something we should try and change? For more than a decade, CNN host and Washington Post columnist Fareed Zakaria has explored radicalization and violent jihad, the frame Why They Hate Us, the title of a new CNN documentary special, comes from a column he wrote years ago for Newsweek magazine. Fareed Zakaria, welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You talk a lot about history, what's changed since you first posed the question, why do they hate us after 9/11? How has that question changed, do you think?
I think in two ways. The first is we now know something about the area where all this hatred is emanating out of, which is the Middle East and the Arab world in particular. And we realize these societies are even more broken than I thought. And once you start trying to reform them, what you discover is, think about Egypt, Libya, Iraq, Syria. Once you get rid of the guy at the top, it turns out there's no state underneath. There is no civil society underneath. In many cases, there's no country underneath. And so these societies very quickly devolve into a kind of political vacuum, a war of all against all, and people retreat to very old identities, not national identities, which are, you know, created in 1919, 1920, but to their identities as Shias, Sunnis, Kurds, Turkmens. These are thousand-year-old identities. And so the task has become much more complicated. And the second is that you have a new generation of jihadis, particularly in Europe, who are young, alienated, not particularly religious, who are drawn to this for the adventure, for the thrill, for the contrast between their miserable, alienated lives, often in which they have spent most of it in kind of petty crimes, often in jail. And those two features, it strikes me, as are the new the new reality we face, a broken Middle East and a very alienated group of non-religious jihadis.
Rashid Khalidi talks a little bit about what he thinks is motivating many of the contemporary jihadis. And listen to what he says here.
In many cases, they're petty criminals. In many cases, they're dropouts. In many cases, they're unemployed. In many cases, they're drug users who never had anything to do with religion, have no religious training whatsoever.
You probably know it's not better than me even. Maybe you have studied.
They're completely ignorant, in other words, of religion. And they latch onto radical Islam as a way to act out their alienation.
Do you buy that?
There's no question it's true for the vast majority of this new generation of European recruits. I think there are obviously some who are deeply religious. The old model, the Al-Qaeda model, was a different one. These people were in their 30s often. They were deeply religious, and they had gotten to their radicalism through religion. The European jihadis now that we see in Brussels and Paris, they tend to be 20 years old, 10 years younger. They are often petty criminals. They have no background in Islam. They were radicalized before they were Islamized. And so what you're dealing with is a different phenomenon. It's alienated young men, often in the prisons of France and Belgium. I came to this by trying to figure out a puzzle. Belgium had the largest number of jihadis that were being sent to Iraq and Syria. And I thought to myself, why is this? Why Belgium, of all places? Well, it turns out Belgium has the largest inequality in income, in opportunity, in education between their migrants, who are essentially Moroccans, and their native borns. It also has the worst track record by most measures of assimilation. And that's particularly a Belgian problem because Belgium has no real national identity itself, torn between its Flemish and Walloon identities. And so that began to explain why Belgium had ended up being this incredible feeding ground. And I do buy the idea that, you know, what you're dealing with here is people who are in some kind of revolt against their circumstances, their surroundings, the modern world, who are looking for an off-the-shelf ideology of protest. Now, it's fair to say, Islam today has within it this cancer, this radical political Islam that is a very convenient off-the-shelf ideology of protest. And why does that exist? Because of decades of having been created, fostered, nurtured by countries like Saudi Arabia.
Like the United States.
Countries like the United States.
I mean, there are billionaires who are Muslims, who were part of the Mujahideen movement in Afghanistan, who to this day operate outside of Afghanistan and in Iran. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, for instance, made millions upon millions of dollars from being a part of that movement. And, you know, if the U.S. gives them such a boost, why should we be so surprised that they wouldn't, you know, succeed?
In the 1980s, we believed that the enemy, you know, the enemy of our enemy is our friend. So anyone who was battling the Soviet Union was a good guy. And that's why we supported Osama bin Laden. That's why we supported people like Hekmatyar, one of the warlords in Afghanistan. And it turned out these people were not our friends. By the way, the Israelis did something very similar when Hamas.
Yeah, they created Hamas.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Hamas is not a Muslim movement. It's a creation of the Israeli state.
In a sense, it's both. And the Israelis at the time, I remember talking to some of them, would say, no, no, you don't understand. Our real enemy is radical left-wing Soviet-backed groups like the PLO. This is a conservative religious group. I mean, they have a lot in common with the, you know, conservative Jewish groups that we know. And so, you know, the world has changed a lot. But my point is that for whatever reason, that ideology now exists. And so when an alienated young European immigrant or a child of an immigrant, which is what it usually is looking around, there is this off-the-shelf ideology. It's on the internet. It's, you know, there are sermons, and that's what they reach for. It's not to deny the importance of religion, but it's to recognize that it's a more complicated story in which there is alienation first, radicalization, and then Islamization.
You speak with a fellow on trial in London, Anjem Chowdhury, who is very angry at the United States. He's also very articulate. And let's listen to an exchange between the two of you.
And then the floodgates open. with the reasons why Anjum Chowdhury says he hates us.
Freedom of expression, freedom of religion. These things sound very nice, but where was the freedom of religion and expression for people in Guantanamo Bay? What about the people being tortured in Abu Ghraib and Bagram? Was that freedom in practice? I bet you loved that, didn't you, Fareed? Did you hold that up as an example of liberty and democracy, the American way, the American life?
Is he wrong to say that Guantanamo is a systematic denial of human rights on any level of prisoners?
No, but what I would point out is, you know, 9/11 was planned when there was no Guantanamo. The attack on the USS Cole was planned when there was no Guantanamo. The attacks on the embassies in Tanzania and Kenya were planned when there was no Guantanamo. You know, so what he is cherry picking a few terrible examples of American mistakes, even crimes, you could call them. And he is claiming that that was the reason for the jihad, but the jihad well preceded it.
Mr. Chowdhury, and this we'll conclude on this. Mr. Chowdhury seems to know your work very, very well, and I know that you know that he does. He follows it. A lot of people in the Muslim world follow your work. He seemed to kind of wink and nod that you're a mouthpiece for American mythology. Do you run the risk of becoming in the English-speaking world and the American world, for instance, which isn't terribly knowledgeable about Islam, being, you know, kind of Egyptian Muslim explainer dude, and that is a limitation ultimately on your ability to elucidate what's going on in the world?
I face many challenges in this regard. You know, I came to the world of international relations as a scholar. I got my PhD at Harvard. It had nothing to do with Islam.
Right.
I wrote about, you know, U.S. foreign policy between the Civil War and Theodore Roosevelt. And then 9/11 happens, and I just know a lot about this because I grew up in that world. My father was actually an Islamic scholar. And so I sort of ended up spending more time and more of my effort explaining it. I feel as though I have to be true to myself, and that person is a very passionate, patriotic American immigrant who also happens to know a lot about the world of Islam and understands how it is being unfairly vilified and demonized. And I try to represent those two positions. There are some people who think I'm an Uncle Tom. I've had a fatwa issued against me by a very serious radical imam, and I get, if you were to look at my Twitter feed, I get the most ugly kinds of bigoted, racist stuff on there. And maybe, you know, in the middle there somewhere, I feel as though I'm telling the truth.
Fareed Zakaria, thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure to be on.
Fareed Zakaria, host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS program, and he's a columnist for The Washington Post.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. Audible, provider of audiobooks performed by narrators like Emma Thompson, James Franco, Alan Cumming, and others. More at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you.
Since this winter was the warmest in the lower 48 states since record keeping started 121 years ago, according to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the idea of a growing season gets distorted and predictions get squishy for farmers and others. The recent strong El Niño weather pattern is partly to blame, but warmer, shorter winters will be more common as climate change trends continue. As Mose Bushell reports from member station KUT in Austin, farmers and ranchers are some of the first people who have to make some very risky decisions that could determine what ends up on all of our dinner tables.
There's nothing strange about enjoying a good, fresh-picked strawberry.
That is delicious. I just spilled some juice on myself. It's so juicy.
But there is something strange about when and where I was enjoying this one. Marburger Orchard is in Fredericksburg, Texas. Gary Marburger's main business is peaches. He keeps berries for the off-season. And this year, it was the way off-season. I visited Marburger in February, early for berries, even in Texas.
And we're seeing them much earlier this year than we ever have. Normally, we would just now maybe be getting started, and we already started a month ago this year.
That's because this winter, the farmer took a gamble. Betting on fewer frosty nights, he started tending his plants early.
And then still it's a gamble. You can go ahead and do it, and then the forecast isn't correct, and then again you've wasted and put a lot of time and effort into it.
But walking through well-maintained rows of berries, you can see it paid off.
And you can see them in all stages. We're looking here at all the way from bloom to little green ones to bigger green ones, and then eventually they start showing some red on them.
He says in his 35 years farming the Central Texas Hill Country, it feels like winters just don't get as cold as they used to, and he may grow more early crops in years to come. He probably won't be alone, says Norma Fowler. Fowler is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin who specializes in plant biology.
There's actually getting to be quite a scientific literature, quite a collection of scientific studies where people have actually documented that things are happening earlier in the spring.
And, of course, it's not just in Texas. In California, some wine growers may move further north, while others change the type of grapes they grow. In New England, the apple harvests are at risk. Fowler says some things that require cold winter nights will be harder to plant.
On the other hand, you might be able to grow something now that you couldn't have grown 20 years ago.
Like strawberries in the winter. This disruption is also not limited to plants.
We have more dust, which can create some respiratory problems.
Heat stress on the animal will affect their production.
The sows aren't comfortable, and so they just don't perform as well.
This is from a video called Climate Change Impacts on Animal Agriculture. It's part of a USDA project to get ranchers, hog, and poultry farmers prepared for global warming.
And it addresses some of the adaptation strategies and approaches that producers are already using in different parts of the nation.
David Smith is a program specialist at Texas A&M University. He works in the project here in the southwestern region where there's a lot of cattle. One way climate change threatens cattle is with warmer summer nights. That leads to heat stress.
What happens is that they stop producing as much milk.
Beef cattle don't eat as much, so they don't gain weight.
They have more reproductive issues.
They have a lot more health problems in general.
Just simply because they can't recover. They can't dissipate that heat that they've retained during the day.
Smith says ranchers are eager to confront the challenge. They're buying cooling systems, even breeding cattle to withstand higher temperatures. Where he runs into resistance is when he links changes in climate to the science of climate change. In Texas, a lot of the people who feel the most immediate impacts of global warming are still skeptical that man plays a role.
There's some regions in the country that are more open to the discussion. For example, up in Washington State, they frequently have climate change workshops.
Here, Smith needs to be a little more creative. He can raise a lot of the same issues without mentioning the C word. One example, his last workshop was on the water, energy, food nexus.
Because if we would have put on a climate change workshop, we probably wouldn't get very many folks at the table.
But that could be changing. A recent Gallup poll shows a record number of Americans believe human activity is causing climate change. Back at Marburger Orchard, I conducted a survey of one. I posed this question to farmer Gary Marburger.
You know, I don't know what your feelings are on climate change. Do you think that's happening? Or
I don't think I'm in a position to say that. And one year can be so drastically different from the next year, and it's up and down. So you know, you're looking more at a, you know, average for overall. And my gut feel is it seems like, and the overall average seems to me like it's, you know, maybe that we're getting into a little bit milder winters than we've had in the past.
He said when he started out 35 years ago, he used to plant a specific variety of peach tree that does better in colder winters. But he wouldn't dream of planting that kind anymore. The winters just seem too warm for it now. For The Takeaway, I'm Mose Bouchel, member station KUT.
Mose's report is the first in a series that explores how we can make our communities stronger and more resilient. It's a collaboration between member stations KPBS in San Diego, OPB in Portland, Oregon, WDET in Detroit, and KUT in Austin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We turn now to sophomore communications major and soccer player for Chicago State University, Chloe Kane. Hey there, Chloe.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I gather you might have
better chosen political science as a major, given the state of the budget in Illinois and all that?
No, I'd rather stick to communications.
Are you going to graduate? I mean, the budget is non-existent in the state of Illinois. You haven't received a dollar from the folks in Springfield at Chicago State University, and they're saying that the school's in danger of shutting down.
Well, yes, this is the case, but students and staff here at Chicago State, we still continue to go about our normal day. As far as I know, no teachers have been laid off. Students are very frustrated, me myself being a student too, but we are still, you know, the doors are still open. We are still going about our normal day, but it's very, very frustrating. I take my education very seriously, and I hope that the budget does eventually pass, because then, you know, we would be funded. But, you know, without that money, it is frustrating from a financial point as well.
Describe to me the importance of Chicago State University on the South Side and as a player in really a community member on in South Side Chicago.
Well, Chicago State University, it brings the community together, you know, through, you know, community outreach programs. You know, we have so many different clubs, so many different activities. It's a foundation, lays the foundation for everyone to come together and really exemplify their talents and be who they are. And the community is so close that without Chicago State University on the South Side, where else would people go to be together? I mean, it connects everybody hand in hand.
Do you think the fact that this is a majority African-American student body in a neighborhood that is known for not being politically empowered in Chicago is part of the reason why you haven't been pushed to the top of the sort of queue as far as state funding is concerned?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons. But again, you know, there's other universities who are struggling with the same problem. They're just not as threatened as we are. I mean, Chicago State University doesn't have that much financial support from alumni or, you know, any partnerships with, you know, other companies and organizations. So we lack an emergency, you know, net funding to fall back on. We rely heavily on our state budget, you know, as a state school. So I think that's one of the main reasons. I do, you know, say that because we're a majority Black university, that does contribute heavily to it. But I think, you know, both of those aspects, you know, contribute to our situation.
Is it the case that you need from the state of Illinois 30% of a $105 million budget, which is like $30 million, something like that, right?
Yes, that is true.
30
yes.
million.
Yeah.
I mean, Trump probably spends that on airline fuel. Right?
Yes, right.
I mean, for heaven's sakes. I mean, well, good luck. I mean, you know, the worst case scenario is you are getting an education of your life. That's for sure, Chloe.
Yes. And that's the thing. I chose Chicago State as my school of choice to continue my athletic and academic career. And I would hate to see these doors close. And, you know, we're on a wing and a prayer. We're on faith that, you know, that they pass the budget and Chicago State University doors stay open.
Chloe Kane is a sophomore in communications major and a soccer player at Chicago State University. Where you what? Are you a striker? What do you play?
I play forward. Yeah, I am a striker.
All right. She sounds like it. Chloe, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Have a good one.
Senator Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz got the delegate headlines over the weekend. Wyoming's Democratic caucus went for Senator Sanders, while Senator Cruz nabbed all 34 delegates in Colorado at that state's GOP convention. But the drama this week is in the great state of New York, where Trump needs a win to take all of the state's delegates, while Hillary Clinton needs a decisive win to stay above the fray over Bernie Sanders. It's T-minus 7 days until primary day. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Hi, Todd.
Hi, John.
So the headline is both conventions are going to be contested. What do you think? I mean, it's looking like it's inching towards two very interesting conventions.
Yeah, the Republican convention is looking almost certain. I can't say that it's certain to be a contested convention. And certainly Donald Trump is going to be doing everything he can between now and next week in New York and the end of the primaries to prevent that. Bernie Sanders, at the same time, is making those noises that if Hillary Clinton walks in to the Democratic convention without a majority of pledged delegates, that he's going to try to contest the convention.
Right.
We'll see if that really happens. That's sort of a different scenario. But the Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, John Kasich scenario on the Republican side is turning into an organizational disaster for Donald Trump. And you really saw it over the weekend. And this has everything to do with 1237 and what happens if Donald Trump can't get there. John, in state after state, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Ted Cruz has been out-organizing and out-maneuvering Donald Trump in every way, grabbing every little delegate from every little corner that he can, making it harder and harder for Trump to either reach 1237 or to get the nomination if he doesn't get it on a first ballot.
What do people anticipate about the convention? What's been talked about over the weekend regarding the tone of either one of these conventions?
Well, you're seeing increasingly heated rhetoric from a lot of sides of this and also new strategies from Donald Trump. Donald Trump has hired a new aide, a new advisor. His name is Paul Manafort. He's experienced in organizing for the small district and state conventions, delegate fights and delegate wars, and also potentially on what it's going to take for the inside game on the convention floor. Now, Paul Manafort was on NBC's Meet the Press over the weekend.
You go to these county conventions and you see the Gestapo tactics, the scorched earth
tactics. Gestapo tactics?
Yeah, they are.
That's a strong word.
Well, you look at, we're going to be filing several protests because the reality is they are not playing by the rules. But frankly, that's the side game because the only game I'm focusing on right now is getting delegates.
Getting delegates, it would seem, is the game. But Donald Trump in Rochester, New York, even called that a corrupt deal.
And he's complained about this, John, over and over as in state after state, Cruz forces outmaneuver him. Listen.
When I look at it and I see all these victories that I have, all these victories that he's got, and then you look at the establishment, and I want to tell you, it's a corrupt deal going on in this country, and it's not good.
They're going to argue for weeks, not over who's winning, but who is stealing. And that just gives the impression of the GOP as an utterly corrupt enterprise to the nation at large. That just can't be a terribly good message as we lead up to the general.
Or at least dysfunctional. And that's part of why New York coming up next week is so important to Donald Trump, both in terms of narrative, more important, raw delegate numbers. 95 delegates at stake in Donald Trump's home state. He's leading by double digits. If he gets over 50% in New York, not only does he get the headlines and the winning, he gets winner take all.
Can Bernie pull off a magic scenario in New York and, if not beat Hillary Clinton, get close enough to again make the case that this is going to be a contested convention too?
Well, Bernie Sanders is on a hot streak. People have heard about it. 8 of the last 9 state contests, but again, on the Democratic side, that's not really what it's about. It's about delegate counts, and the Democrats don't have winner-take-all. They have all-proportional, which means even when Hillary loses, she wins, or at least she stays ahead. In Wyoming over the weekend, Bernie Sanders beat her 56-44% in Wyoming, but the delegates, John, they split them 7-7. That's the Democratic rules. Hillary Clinton right now has a double-digit lead. She is popular in New York. She won statewide there twice. Bernie Sanders, of course, is from Brooklyn, but she does have a lead. I don't want to put too much stake in the polling, but it looks like New York is not going to be a place where Bernie Sanders can bite into her lead.
Well, it certainly is novel to be a New Yorker and to have the actual presidential campaign be relevant in this state.
That's right.
For the first time since, you know, really 1988. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
John, I want to put my hand on your shoulder as a New Yorker and tell you that you matter.
Thanks, Todd. I'm weeping. It's beautiful. Cars have always been greasy, oily, and very rough and tumble male kinds of objects, in short, endowed with all of the traits of maleness. Cars are parked right in the center of the gender myths and realities of American culture, in fact, perhaps because some of the men at General Motors a while ago felt they had run out of ideas of how to improve what was fast becoming the American favorite consumer product, They did something radical.
The fair sex of America strikes again. This time in the nation's auto industry, where women designers have opened up a whole new field of employment. Here in the styling studios of General Motors, they select fabrics, colors, accessories, and help design cars inside and out. Today's modern woman, no longer just a voice from the back seat, has the last word in the purchase of 7 out of 10 cars. So the feminine taste is represented by these girls, a few of the many damsels of design.
In the mid-1950s, GM hired a team of 10 pioneers, designers, women. They called them the damsels of design, which might have been a questionable move, but an all-female design team of 10 who were seen to have the aesthetic sensibility that American car consumers could appreciate.
This champagne white is trimmed with pearls. A notepad in the glove compartment for thoughts while waiting. If it's a dark, overcast day, these talented designers are prepared. In fact, they've already led the way with six-way seats, easy-to-reach dashboard controls, and upholstery that won't snag their nylons.
They managed to have an impact on the cars and culture at GM. Rebecca Veit says she's a designing women columnist for Core 77. But Veit says in the end, at that time, there wasn't really much of a future for women in the design field in the American auto industry.
You know, their story of the damsels of design really starts actually with a man. His name was Harley Earl, and he was the VP of design at GM. And he really recognized before his contemporaries that women in the post-war era really had a lot more buying power, and they were making a lot more decisions about the home and kind of the car as an extension of the home. And so he really wanted to bring in, I think, what he would call kind of as the feminine touch to GM's car design and kind of lure in kind of this new market of consumers. And GM's PR department really saw a great opportunity to kind of promote the women they were bringing in and dub them the damsels of design.
Now, I'm sure they must have been thrilled with that name, but were they actual designers?
They were. Earl really was recruiting from industrial design programs. He recruited heavily from Pratt Institute in Brooklyn and also from Cranbrook in Detroit. So the 10 women that he hired were all industrial designers. And, you know, they really kind of hated the name being called the damsels. They really felt like it didn't give them a fair shake as designers.
Yeah, I'm shocked by that. How did they interact inside the company? Any indication? And what did they actually get to work on?
So 6 of them went directly into GM's automotive design department, and they were placed in the interiors department. So they were really designing interiors from the ground up. The PR department at GM really promoted them kind of as decorators. So, you know, saying, oh, they're throwing around fabrics and choosing colors. But really, they were doing the exact same work that the men there were doing. One thing that GM specifically did was promote them with what they called the Feminine Auto Show. And so this was really a time for them to kind of show their taste, show their design prowess. They designed 2 to 3 automobiles each and really put in some interesting kind of innovations. In the Corvette, they had the first retractable seatbelt. They had things like light-up makeup mirrors, which weren't really a thing at the time. They had kind of fun storage consoles for picnics and for umbrellas. And they also put in some new safety features, thinking about children in the car. They had some of the first safety latches that could be controlled on the dashboard for children in the back seat. Things like that did come through at the time. And I think there were a lot of women in America as well as Europe who were designing, who were kind of flying under the radar, either because they weren't taken seriously or because they were working with their husbands and they were kind of in their shadow at the time.
Was the culture of design changed at General Motors in any significant way by this program?
You know, it was a kind of a brief blip, unfortunately. They brought them in around 1955. In 1958, Harley Earl retired. And the man who came after him kind of famously said, you know, no women are going to stand next to my male senior designers. So by the early 60s, they were gone. There was one woman who stayed on. Her name was Suzanne Vanderbilt. And she kind of tenaciously worked her way up through the ranks at GM for the next 23 years. But I read an interview with her, and the interviewer asked her, you know, how many women in the early 70s were working at GM? And she said, well, you know, there's about one in every design studio, so six total. And that was the exact same number that were working on automobile design when she started in 1955.
And I think it's probably progressive compared to designers who are male back then, because I think male designers probably were designing for men, or they were designing to express their own personal signature, almost as an extension of their own ego. So in a sense, the women are really leapfrogging far ahead of the design aesthetic of, you know, what they encounter there at General Motors.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, something that the women were doing were they were kind of thinking a little bit more holistically, and they were thinking about how people were using the interiors of the car, how families were going to be using the interiors of the car. And, you know, people like Suzanne Vanderbilt, who did stay on at GM, in the 60s, she came up actually with a patent because people were complaining that the seats in the cars were so uncomfortable. She came up with a patent for an inflatable seat back, which you could kind of pump up or decrease the air pressure and give you lumbar support. And that was actually something that GM looked over and didn't put into production until decades later.
You're someone who is very familiar with the design culture of the 21st century. How would you say the ways in which men and women express themselves artistically in design has a different dynamic than it ever had back in this period that you study?
I think the women who were referred to as the damsels of design by GM, they really thought of themselves as designers for men and women, and they didn't see themselves as designers just for women. I think that kind of design thinking was very forward at the time, and I think it carries over kind of to today, that people are designing for people, and, you know, female designers today don't want to be thought of as designing just for women. They want to be thought of just designing for everybody.
Rebecca Veit, Designing Women columnist for Core 77, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
For more on those damsels, including photos, go to thetakeaway.org. And here's something to take with you today. It wasn't exactly the hottest ticket in town, but 200 people last Friday in D.C. showed up at the federal government's first public hearing on the viability of driverless cars. For more than 7 hours, the discussion raged at the Federal Highway Traffic Safety Administration. From we need to be at the leading edge of this technology to these are dangerous weapons we must eradicate from the start before they are adopted around the world. Think of it, a room full of backseat drivers before a single driverless unit shows up. If you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. If you like what you hear, give us a rating. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your driverless podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Who's gonna drive you home
tonight? Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.